You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
I'm Sarah Custer. I'm digital editor at Times Higher Education. And I would like to introduce our panelists, who I just learned are both tenors. So if we've got some time after the discussion, maybe we could have some Christmas carols from them, if we're lucky. And they're both, quite interestingly, started out their careers studying humanities and then switched over to computer science. So first we have Nathan Lee. He's a senior research fellow at the UCL Institute of Health Informatics. And he started out with a BA in classics from UCL. Then he shifted into the area of IT and healthcare, earning a master's from UCL's Department of Computer Science. He's worked in private software development. And he's just gone back to the hallowed halls of UCL to do some research in the role of information systems in supporting healthcare delivery. And he's perhaps the only person in the room who understands fully the general data protection regulations, GDPR, except for maybe Kate, I don't know. And then, of course, we have Kate Devlin, who started out her career in the humanities as well, earning a bachelor's degree in archaeology from King's University Belfast before she went back to Queen's University to study a master's in computer science. She got her PhD in computer science from Bristol and is now a senior lecturer in the Department of Digital Humanities at King's College London. And her research focuses on human-computer interactions and AI. And her most recent book is titled Turned On: Science, Sex, and Robots. So I will hand it over to our speakers to kind of do a little bit of an introduction into where they're coming from, what background they're coming from to this conversation of ethics and AI. And then I've got some questions for them, but please feel free. This is a very informal environment. So if you do have a question, just raise your hand or just kind of interrupt us, and please join the conversation. And we also have we have lapel mics, but these are mostly for recording, but it sounds like they are connected to the PA, so hopefully everybody can understand us. Nathan, why don't you start just telling us a little bit about where you're coming from in terms of approaching this topic of the ethics of AI.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I hope you can hear me okay. It seems to be coming through quite well. So I started really in the area of digital health about 20 years ago. And it was back then that we were looking at the future of delivering information, but also processing data using what were called grid systems. That was the AI of the day about 20 years ago. So it was a brand new technology, introduced quite a culture shock, especially since the Department of Trade and Industry, as it was then, had funded a large degree of work to try and get researchers from different backgrounds, so scientists and humanities people, to work together and solve problems together with this new technology. So what we had was effectively ethics committees that were used to dealing with health research questions suddenly being presented with these computing areas that they had no clue about. And why would they? We'd never looked at this. There's a big culture shock. Likewise, in the computing research area, they'd never had any real exposure or experience in health or sensitive data handling. So there was a massive learning requirement that was there, to the point that this made me shift my PhD topic away from experimental computing to information governance, because when it came down to it, there were many gaps in knowledge. This innovation drive has continued across the world, and from grid systems, we started to verge more into the area of high-performance computing, but also big data, where we're looking at massive population-scale data sets. And this, in turn, has evolved into something that's been going on for some decades in terms of AI research. We now have the capacity and the capability to develop these autonomous systems that can perhaps make better decisions than we humans can. So that area is the real challenge. And because of my exposure to ethics and governance and the recent landing of GDPR, which has been big on my radar in the last 2 years and many people's radars, there's much more around transparency, much more around people's rights in terms of decision making. This has become so much more topical. So I'm looking at this from a very nuanced background in the past, where rights and autonomy are critical when delivering research for public good and public benefit, but balancing the public interest as well. There are safety concerns too, which I'm hoping that we can explore.
Fantastic. And I think the topic of population scale data sets and kind of the different sectors that we're using this information in is something that we'll definitely come back to in our discussion. Kate.
Okay, well, first up, I'm here today because my institution didn't meet the threshold for strike, so otherwise I'd be on a picket line, so I'm pleased that I'm able to be here. So, I started out looking at people and how they interact with technology. That was where my interest was. And from a background in archaeology, looking how technology changes through time and how we have this fear around technology that is just every time something new comes along, we kind of tend to invest too much fear into it. And it's never usually as bad as we think it's going to be. And there are a lot of benefits that we overlook because we panic about it. So I wanted to kind of get to grips with what the reality of it all was. And for 12 years, I was working in the computer science department. And I was looking from a lens of human-computer interaction and AI about how cognitive systems were being developed and about how we were implementing AI and applying it. And in that, I got more and more drawn into this wonderful community of AI ethics researchers, which the UK has quite a strong group. And I find myself working more and more in terms of how we apply those and also the amount of bias that creeps in. So I'm very interested in what messages companies are sending out, in what messages are reaching the consumers, and how they're handling knowledge about this technology. And interestingly, in Kevin Fong's keynote just now, he said technology is neutral. And I was at the back going, no, technology is not neutral. It's not neutral. I don't think we can fairly say that. But to say technology is neutral is an incredible STEM approach, right? So that's what you hear from the tech people. That's what you hear from Silicon Valley. Oh, we're making technology. It's neutral. It's a passive tool. I think if you come from another angle, like digital humanities, then you realize that that's not the case. There are decisions being made right from the inception of the idea about how this can be used, and it's affording a certain type of behavior. So I would say that now, working in a digital humanities department, I'm able to fortunately get a much wider scope on all of this, because when you're in a computing department, it tends to be very narrowly focused on what the actual technology is. But when you look at, when you step outside of that and you see the many different facets, it becomes really, really interesting. So I'm kind of interested in how we can have interdisciplinarity in the subject. But also, we have seen such a brain drain of talent going to industry from higher education. So we are seeing people finishing their PhDs immediately going out to big corporations, or big name professors joining Google, Microsoft, Facebook. And we are starting, there is going to be a problem getting those people back into universities to do research, because universities cannot compete with the amazing salaries and free beer and bean bags that the companies offer. So yeah, that's pretty much where I am.
Fantastic. So as you can see, we have some overlap in where you guys are coming from, but also some really quite stark differences. So I'm really looking forward to hearing your responses to my questions. First, I would like to set the scene a little bit, and I'm going to rob from some of your ideas, Kate, in a piece that you wrote for THE, an opinion piece that you wrote for us, that was based on the premise of Silicon Valley kind of developing with this attitude of think fast and break things, act fast and break things. And Kate, what you argued in that piece was to say, actually, no, the role of universities in this massive accelerated progress is to think slowly and fix things. So I guess my first question for the two of you is to think about, what are the big questions, the big ethical questions about AI that are keeping you up at night?
The main one, and I think everyone is aware of it now, is bias and just how biased systems are. Not just in terms of the algorithms themselves, but in terms of the data sets that we use. And it's incredibly difficult to fix that. And we know that. We know people are aware of it. The big companies are aware of it. But no one's quite aware how to fix it.
Why is it difficult to fix that? Is it because we're using historical data? We need this big data sets, and the historical data that we have is based on...
That's one aspect, biases. Yeah. Okay. So that's one aspect. One aspect is the data sets themselves are flawed in that we are collecting from certain demographics, are people excluded, it's not being collected, it's not necessarily representative, lots of things. And then the algorithms themselves are perpetuating that.
Yes.
And because of the black box nature of things like deep learning, we don't know what's going on. We can look at what's going in and we can look at what comes out, but we don't always know necessarily what's happening in the middle. And often it's entrenching those biases. So I think that's what worries me, is just even though we know it's a problem, we don't really have good ways of fixing that. That and deep fakes, which I think are one of the scary things around AI. If we can fake video and images so well that we're always trying to catch up on how to identify them, then you know this has huge ramifications in the political world.
And deep fakes, are those mostly contained to media consumption and information, or are we seeing deep fakes in other areas of AI usage?
I think, as far as I know, I mean, it's not my main research area at all. So, but I think we're starting to see the potential for them to be used in other media things, but in politics as well.
Yeah.
So that's problematic.
All right, biases and deep fakes, Nathan.
So I think I have two really grave concerns about this. One of them is about the autonomy of the algorithms that are being developed and their sophistication. In effect, I've taken the view that we're not just programming things from a static standpoint, we're actually educating something to behave in a way that is, to date, unpredictable. So we would hope that education is grounded, it's kind, it's fair, it's reasonable. But as Kate mentioned, we have issues around the quality of the data, in effect. We have issues around the predisposition with historic decision-making in terms of employment and recruitment and so forth. Very real issues about discrimination and lack of equity. So we've got to be very careful about this. And I just feel that we have to accept that this is an issue. It's not an ivory tower problem. It's a very real concern.
Can I just interrupt you right there? And I'm going to kind of play the role, a very realistic role, of kind of being the person who really doesn't understand AI that much. So whenever you say the autonomy of algorithms, my mind immediately goes to kind of a sentient being, some sort of like high intelligent thing that is working beyond kind of the control of its master, let's say, super sci-fi stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
I'm talking about more or less. I'm not saying they're sentient yet. That's some way off. What I'm saying is they're so sophisticated, they're difficult to predict, in effect. And I think that's where we have to treat them as autonomous, because we simply cannot know what the result will be.
Okay.
And that's a real practical engineering concern when it boils down to it. But what I want to do is to make sure that we understand that we have to humanize this somehow, and that when we are doing the deep learning and the training of the algorithms, we have to be very careful about that. If I think about all my educational experience, teaching and so forth, I try and make sure I double check, triple check that I'm not being biased, that I'm not being prejudiced in how I present materials and how I discuss topical events. And I've had it all in the last 2 years. There's all the AI work, the Brexit work, the political side and so forth. And I have my own published opinions on this, but that can't skew the core facts about a particular situation. Taking it to the level of actually training algorithms up, using data that may be incomplete, it may be poor quality, it may be inaccurate, and it may be based on, like I was saying, decisions from the past that we might think better of now. We have to make sure that we have that in place to ensure that the training of the algorithms don't repeat our past mistakes, in effect. And the extent to which we appreciate this as engineers, because strictly speaking, I am a software engineer, I can see how engineering can dehumanize problems, break them down into manageable chunks. Now we've got so many manageable chunks that we can't really manage the traditional engineering paradigms. I think it's time for a new enlightenment in terms of how we use those and apply those.
Taking a page from the Kevin Fong book, from his plenary that we just saw, I'm wondering if you could comment on kind of how we got to where we are now. If we are using incomplete data sets, if there are so many biases, I mean, there are so many obvious flaws to this. So why do we keep pushing forward?
There's so much hype around AI, and it's a big money spinner. And there's been very uncritical uptake until. So if you look at sort of the progression through AI and what was happening, we saw this 2012 when deep learning came about, and Google published their paper on that. We saw this explosion in the use of AI, and I mean, sometimes it's not even AI. Sometimes it's just using the name of AI. Well, essentially machine learning. But we saw, so there was this rise, and companies were adding it because it was the thing to add. And I think if you dig deep into some of those companies, you find out they're not really doing machine learning. They're just doing some clever stats. But it went on and on. It wasn't until 2017 that you start seeing the first wave of ethics papers coming out going, hang on, we might have a problem here. So it took that long for people to go, oh, well, that's amazing, the results are amazing, and then to go, we've seemed to have got it a bit wrong. So I think there's been lots of move fast and break things going on where people, developers, have rushed ahead, and there is no regulation. There's no governance regulation yet about how things are developed. So, you know, things like when Google acquired DeepMind, DeepMind asked for an ethics board to be set up. We don't know who's on that ethics board. They've never disclosed that. Google then tried a few months ago to set up an advisory board. That fell apart within a week. So, you know, Facebook, well, I mean, they've got issues. So, you know, we've got, there's nothing, in academia, we have the ethics board. You know, if I want to do any kind of work that involves data, I have to have a plan for that data. I have to go through an ethics board for clearance and risk clearance. That's not the case when you're developing things in-house in a company. There may be some internal structures, but there's not really any audit going on of what's happening. The governance hasn't caught up with this either. At what level do we do governance? Do we keep it within the country for a government to control? I wouldn't particularly trust our government to do a lot of work on governing tech. They've not got the best track record. The House of Lords AI report was excellent. It was really good. It highlighted all these risks, but it's not a plan for actual governance. Mm. So we are left kind of going, well, what do we do? How do we actually regulate this? And no one really has an answer yet.
We'll come back to this topic about regulation, because I think there's more to say on that. But Nathan, I wanted to put it to you. Do you think there is an issue with public understanding of what AI actually is? Because I think people talk about AI, but what they're really talking about is machine learning or maybe some fancy statistics. First of all, do you think the public actually understands what AI is? And second of all, is that important in this discussion about ethics?
Well, I'll take the last part first. Absolutely, it's vital. I think the ethics is something that is not owned by one group or stakeholder. It relies on impartiality, it relies on wisdom that cannot simply be held by the company or the institution trying to develop the AI. It has to be external, has to be critical. In terms of public knowledge about this, it's always difficult to gauge, because treating the public as some kind of entity to which you might ascribe a degree of skill or talent or knowledge is hard. And I think a lot of what we've been doing in the research area across all our faculties and all our areas of study is to have much greater emphasis on public engagement and involvement, particularly in the healthcare area. People are absolute experts on their experience as a patient, so I wouldn't necessarily know or understand that. They do. Mm. They have so much to offer, and we have to engage with them. My sense is that I think we've been exposed to the notion of AI either through media and science fiction and entertainment, or through other treatises. You know, more and more we've had recent reports and so forth about things going right and going wrong and so forth. So I think they will have a view, they will have a sense of it, but the core understanding of what's actually at play may not be there to the point that we're being entirely transparent or can be entirely transparent yet. So in terms of engaging with publics and groups in particular, it always has to be from a context. So that's where I think we still have a lot of work to do. But I think the ownership of the problem, and just to pick up a couple of points you were making, if I may, sure, especially on that last question, it reminds me a little bit of the 12-step program. Now, I've never done it, I'll say that now, but I think the first step is admitting you have a problem. So I think we're at step one, but we've only been able to really realize we've got a problem. And I think a lot of that's to do with the work around big data, because we're looking at data at scale. We're suddenly realizing, hang on, there's incompleteness here. There's been some misuse of information. Mm. There's been misunderstanding about information. And I think that's really helping us put a lens on not only how we handle this area, but also how we engage more with the public and have a two-way conversation and build up a relationship when it comes down to it. We can't tick the PPI box in the engagement blocks and say, right, we've done that, move on. This is an ongoing concern, and there are interests that will be thriving throughout.
Okay, I'm going to shift track a little bit and go into the world of higher education, because that's why we're all here. How much do you think AI will impact universities and just the business of universities? I'm thinking student assessments, testing hypotheses, which is where it's already perhaps being used. But how far is that reach going to go, do you reckon?
So one of the places that we've seen AI being deployed is in HR. So using AI in recruitment, that's not got a brilliant track record at all. Mm. So hopefully they won't go down that route. One of the things I've seen recently, and it's raised all kinds of red flags for me, is the use of AI to monitor student progress. And it's been done in schools, and it's been done uncritically. And there was an expose in a newspaper recently about a group that was doing this. There was a story ran about it. It wasn't necessarily an expose. But when I sort of looking around in the background to see, well, what's the basis for this? Where's the peer review papers? There weren't any that I could find. And you think, you're storing data about a child in school, about their performance, about their possible emotions and mental health, and you're saying that you can pass this record on throughout their school life. And who's storing that data? Who's in charge of that? What if it's wrong? Who gets to say, you know, whether or not that's right? And there's absolute horrifies me that we would accept that uncritically. So I wonder, you know, I'm sure there will come a time when we're being encouraged to use machine learning to track student progress, to track all sorts of things. And I would be really, really hesitant for universities to take that up. I think it's asking for trouble.
Let's take that point, though, because these learning management systems, I agree, are becoming more common in universities. And the counter argument to that is, though, there's a mental health crisis going on. We need to monitor students in all places, and it's not just their grades. It's not just kind of if they're turning up to class. We've got to get those intangibles down so that we can really make sure that our students are succeeding. So what would be your response to that?
I spent 5 years as senior tutor in my department at Goldsmiths, and we were dealing with students with very severe some with mental illness, some with mental health crises. And I did a study on this, and the one thing that students really wanted was someone to check in with them. It wasn't for them to come to us and say everything's going okay. It was for people to be able to check in all the time. And I know that when it comes to monitoring data, that's a very quick and effective way, if it works. But, you know, there are all sorts of privacy reasons why I don't think we should even go down that. What I think works is putting an investment into mental health provision in universities. It's not a crisis that can be fixed by technology. A lot of it is to do with joined up care. It's about people moving into new trusts when they join a university and the continuity of care is failing. I think in an ideal world, I would have every department would have some kind of mental health advisor or like a guidance counsellor who would be there to deal with student engagement, student mental health, all that kind of thing. And I know that's an expensive resource, but I think it's one that's worth it. I think we have to go down the human loop on this and not in the machine one.
All right. Nathan, any comment on that? Or
absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So I've taken on roles as a personal tutor, supervisor. I'm a bullying confidant in my department. And the issues that come up have been expressed to me on a one-to-one basis in confidence, and then I can do something to help, and we find the right resources to support whoever's coming to me with that. In terms of having technology somehow involved in that relationship makes me nervous, because again, you lose the human contact, you lose the continuity, and I trust my instincts when things crop up. Would I trust profiling by an AI algorithm? There better be any number of certifications applied to that algorithm and registrations and so forth, independent review of those systems and tools to make me even think that I might consider what it's saying to me. But this is where I think GDPR is a very positive thing. Anyone can object to decisions made by AI, by profiling. Now, the kind of dividing line there is that if the decision is made and action is taken by the system, falls into that category. If advice is given to a person like myself to make the decision, it doesn't fall into that category because I'm making the decision. Now, I worry we blur those lines a little bit, but when it boils down to it, data subjects have a right to say, I want a human to make that decision. And that's important here. That regulates things in a very specific way. And I think that keeps us on the level in that regard. The flip side of this is I wouldn't want to unnecessarily hinder the understanding of how these algorithms and these systems might work, because that too is part of GDPR. Technology has to drive the evolution of data and its management. So it's a balancing act. The extent to which it's come around in higher education and how far it may go, or in any educational system, I'm not entirely convinced that it'll replace our decision making yet, but we have to be empowered to make those decisions.
I would say there is a place for technology. There may be a place for machine learning, and one of those may be through support and through reporting. Mm-hmm. So we could use technology as an opt-in, where if students, I mean, there have been trials with sort of therapy bots, like things like Wobot and Wise, where They can be used to monitoring moods, things like that. Perhaps we make those available to students, but it shouldn't be something that universities are controlling, and it shouldn't be something that is default. Right. But it may be that we can use those tools to support people.
Good points. Any questions right now before I... Billy? Sorry, just one second. Have we got a mic that we should be using, Alex? Okay.
Shiny, thank you.
Okay, so we've got Billy here, and was there another comment question over there? Okay, I'll go back to you. Yep.
Both panelists talked about removing bias as part of the ethical problem. But I just want to raise the point that sometimes the ethical thing to do is tolerate some bias. So, for example, if you have an image recognition system that can help you identify missing children, but it works better for some ethnic groups than others. So in those situations, you have to dilemma. Should you wait until you make it completely fair for all ethnic groups, or deploy it as soon as possible so that at least some ethnic groups can benefit?
Sorry, before you answer that, I'm going to take the other question. And if you could just introduce yourself as well. Billy is also one of the lead data scientists at Times Higher Education.
Okay, I'm Deborah from Turnitin.
And what is Turnitin, Deborah?
I knew that I'd get a reaction.
Maybe everybody knows what Turnitin is. Okay, everyone seems to know that. Okay.
So I was just wondering what your thoughts are on how AI can actually improve your teaching and learning experience. At Turnitin, we actually believe that the human element is as important as technology. So I'm kind of on the fence with what you're saying right now, everything. So I'm just keen to get your thoughts on whether you use any sort of AI technology in your teaching and learning currently.
Okay, good. Any other questions at this point? Oh, great. I'll take one more, and then we'll let Nathan and Kate answer.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Dr. Shilpi from India MIT University. My question is, if we are talking of the decade, then we shift from mobile computing, then cloud computing, and then finally we reach to AI. But in perspective of telemedicine or the healthcare, the AI has still maintained a gap. Its gap is not fulfilled because of the data or the forgery, the impatience, everything. So I just want you to focus on this if there is any aspect. Thank you. As a researcher point of view, for my students, thank you.
Fantastic. Okay, so we've got when should we tolerate bias? If we're talking about facial recognition, searching for lost children. Has it helped you at all in terms of your teaching and learning? And then I'm not going to try to sum up that last question, but I hope you guys understand it. Who wants to go first?
So I guess that's a good case where bias may be the better, lesser of two evils. Do you find no children or do you find just some children? I guess that's, a tolerable thing. And I think this is why it needs to be a discussion into all of this. Everyone is biased. We can't get away from that. We all have our own inbuilt biases anyway, but we have to think very carefully about where we're collecting data from. And one of the examples I use in my class is, I wear a fitness tracker. I wear Fitbit. All my information goes back to that company, and I willingly give in my data because I want to use their product. And Fitbit have taken the data, and they've made some medical discoveries from it. They published medical papers of findings from Fitbit data. Mm. But the thing is, that data comes from a very specific demographic of people who are able to afford to wear a health tracker, who are healthy enough to want to wear a health tracker. And we're excluding, vast numbers of people. So, we may have benefits there medically for my particular demographic that's excluding others. And I think we need to be really aware of that when we see the results that are coming out and know that there are gaps and there are people missing from the data sets. Yeah.
Okay. Any comment on the other two questions?
I was going to say about Turnitin. I would love it if we could have a Turnitin that works on code. I know there's other versions that do that, but
like catching plagiarism in code.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. There are some tools, but they're not
okay.
They work quite.
Making note.
Right.
There we go, product placement,
brilliant.
Perfect. Okay, Nathan?
To pick up your point about bias, I think we should think very carefully about how we articulate the problem. So I do take your point that there is benefit here without necessarily labeling something as discriminatory. But I think we have to be very clear about how the algorithms have learned, how they've been developed and so forth. And that if there is bias in the data, then we know it's there. We can do something about it.
And sometimes even when the data is completely fair, it's just a fact of physical reality that white skin reflects light better than dark skin. So image recognition will always work better for some ethnic groups than the others.
Well, this is it. But also knowing that and understanding that means that we can get some kind of equivalence. You know, we can alter the technology, we can do better at making sure it works for everyone. I've come from a background where we talk about the digital divide and health inequality, where people may not be in a position to be able to afford the other kind of nice gadgets and the nice interventions that help them manage their conditions. They may have educational deficits because they haven't been able to engage for whatever reason, whether it's to do with their mental health, whether it's to do with their backgrounds. And this is something we're acutely aware of. But I think this is where we do have to think outside the box and say, right, how will this help benefit more people? And that's a fundamental element of the medical profession and the research profession as well. So this is by no means a kind of, it's bad, let's not do it. This is a, right, let's understand the nature of it and see how we can continue to do better. I think in terms of how it would impact my educational delivery and so forth with Turnitin and so forth. So one of the modules I lead on is very much about critical appraisal. It's very much about exploring issues. It's information law and governance and clinical practice. Now, it's going to be very hard to get an algorithm to judge what is actually a good submission, because when it boils down to it, it's down to myself and my secondary markers to be able to assess how someone deals with a knotty problem. The scenario we have is suspected child abuse in the clinical setting, and the balance of breaching confidence versus the interests of the individuals involved. Now, there is no one answer. There are thousands. And in fact, my students have come up with stuff that I didn't even think of. You know, so that's really the challenge area for this, I think, in real terms. But to take your point as well, that's very much about understanding context and trying to make sure that we apply algorithms have been trained on bias data or not in an area that we don't fully understand is exactly what you're highlighting here. There's the gap, there's the issue where things haven't been quite so well discovered, which is why we do have to think slowly and carefully and fix things. That's precisely why the paradigm has shifted.
THG did a big survey earlier this year of AI experts and university presidents, just kind of asking them about the state of AI really, and kind of where they are in terms of the development in higher education. And they were actually quite optimistic that AI wouldn't steal jobs from universities, that actually it would create jobs within higher education. But one thing that stood out for me in that was that universities don't have AI strategies. Yeah. So I'm wondering if you guys could comment on that, just in terms of should universities have AI strategies, and what should that be?
I would like to see AI strategies, and I would like to see it tied in with how can we use this beneficially, fairly, in a diverse manner, and thinking about the consequences. I think all strategies should be thinking about the consequences. Mm. In terms of automation of jobs, I mean, we've had robots replacing jobs for many years. It's only we've panicked now because they're coming for the middle class jobs. So, you know, this when they start to replace the VCs, then you're going to get people, you know, yes. Strategies will definitely emerge. but I think there are certain things. Again, like as Kevin said in his keynote earlier, we all thought MOOCs would be the big thing, and they are not. They're not taking off the way that we thought they would be. So, you know, I'm also inclined to say that's probably the case with a lot of technology. I think we're going to hit another AI winter. It's on the cards that we're going to see
an AI winter.
Yeah, when the bubble bursts and suddenly it goes a bit dark again in terms of research.
It's kind of not trendy or...
Yeah, so there's been a couple of these so far, and, you know, in the 60s and again in the 70s, and where the research can kind of go, oh, we're making great progress, and then you hit a level where you go, actually, we've kind of gone as far as we can go.
Okay.
And then the funding tails off, and then there's a bit of a crash. But the interesting thing about AI winters that have happened already is that new paradigms emerge, new angles come out. So, you know, there was lots of emphasis in the early days of AI on machine translation of language. Mm-hmm. And they were going, oh, we'll solve this in 5 years. And then, you know, 10 years later, they're going, oh, actually, this is quite difficult. And I think we will see another one of those because we're seeing such a hype around AI, and it's trying to deliver a lot of things, but more and more we're seeing the flaws. I also think we're going to see a wave of machine learning scandals where people realise the extent of the bias, realise how their data has been used or misused, and there's going to be people fighting back.
Nathan?
I couldn't agree more.
Good. You know,
I was thinking there's the issue around this is very much more about thinking about when things go wrong. I'm not actually scared I'm going to be out of work, to be honest, because it's going to be, Nathan, what's it done? You know, what's happened here? You know, how's this worked out? And I think there's, what I've realized is that starting my career about 25 years ago, we don't have that sort of one career path anymore. I've kind of reinvented myself probably about three times in the last 20 years, adapting to technology trends and everything. I think there's been a lot of uncertainty about the future of work and so forth. You know, I've made myself comfortable with that. But in terms of the kinds of tasks that AI might actually handle in a higher education setting, I think there's a real understanding we have to have about what it's doing in context and how we can handle it. And I think this is going to generate more potential for jobs for people. May require a bit of retraining, but I've worked with some of the, some what I would call the finest surgeons and consultants in the medical profession for a while. And they never stopped learning. They never stopped updating their skills, even into their 60s, you know, when they were kind of looking at retirement further down the road. You never stop learning and adapting. And we all have to do that, particularly if we're in the innovation space, because we have to understand it. People like me have to ground it somehow in compliance, you know, and we don't know what that looks like either. So we have to keep an open mind on this. And again, I think there are ethical issues with cutting something off because of fear and misunderstanding. So I think we have to learn to be at peace with that. But it's about making sure that we have enriching jobs, enriching careers, and enriching pathways for as many people as possible. And staring down the barrel of someone else's gun in terms of ending something or promoting something is not going to help that.
Mm-hmm. And it's difficult in that we know from previous waves of automation that it often, the people who are losing their jobs, if they're unskilled and have to reskill, it takes a while to do that, because sometimes it takes the next generation to do that. So there will be people who will be out of work, but that can happen with lots of things. And if you look at Uber this week, you know, they're losing their license, so there's tens of thousands of people suddenly out of a job overnight.
Which really has nothing to do with AI.
It has nothing to do with AI, although they use AI in their app. But you know, it's completely out. It's part of circumstances of what's going on. So we are in an economy where there are job losses and things are very precarious. For example, so you know, there are a lot of unskilled jobs that are lost, people will have to reskill or find alternative work. For example, we have a massive shortage in carers. That care work's not going to be carried out by AI or robots anytime soon. Definitely not robots anytime soon. So there's still going to be jobs there. But again, these are jobs that are considered low. They're low paid. They're poorly rewarded. They're hard. They're physical work. So you know, it's not much fun for anyone having to do jobs like that. So I think you know this is a much bigger economic picture that's not just focusing entirely on automation.
When we're thinking about ethics and AI research within a university context, though, I'm wondering how the ever global landscape of higher education can kind of reconcile cultural divisions between ethics and AI, which is something that we're already seeing playing out between GDPR in Europe, what's happening in the US, I mean, Russia, let's not even get started on that. So how should universities kind of move forward with that if we've got some people saying, actually, no, that's not possible over here, but then other people are saying, yeah, take however much data you want, we don't care, let's just move forward with innovation, let's use it in the defense sector, let's use it however we can. What should universities be doing there from an ethical standpoint?
It would be nice to see universities. So the UK is not going to be able to keep up technologically. They're not going to be leaders in the field in terms of AI development technology, because that is going to rest with Silicon Valley. That's where the money is. That's where all the expertise has gone.
But would you say that's where the authority on ethics will be coming from as well?
No, that's the good point. That's the good part. There's a really good ethics community in Europe. The UK, while it cannot lead technologically, I mean, it's making good advances, but we just don't have the levels of funding to compete with the likes of Google or Amazon or Facebook. But we do have a really strong ethics community. And I think that, and certainly the government, the House of Lords report, is pushing for the UK to be a major player in the field of ethics. And I think that is where our strengths lie. And it would be really good to see universities kind of sign up to this idea of ethical development and to promote that in the same way that, you know, universities are very keen to do sustainable development goals or to make policies on climate change. You know, maybe the next policy should be focused on AI to say that we will look at the responsible use of technology going forward.
Really good point. Nathan, any comment on that?
This is anecdotal, but there's been so many issues over the last few decades where I think other players in the international scene have basically sat back and let someone else have a crack at it, mess it up and learn from their mistakes. So I think there is a kind of element of, this is hugely unethical, I suspect, but there's an element of we can do our best to try and make sure that our developers and our workforce, when they say, oh, I'm trying to keep it as international as possible, have an understanding of ethics and critical appraisal when they're actually building these things, for sure. Maybe it'll slow it down, but there are issues that are going to come up. If someone else rushes forward, builds it, makes a mess of it, causes harm, we're going to have to deal with those issues at some point. But we can also warn. We can also say, listen, please, you know, if you want to go and develop something for your defense sector, think about this. Think about this. My work within the NHS, for example, we've been through 3 independent reviews, one about information security. And one of the things that independent review found was that people weren't sharing good or bad practice. So in terms of those areas, it's a fundamental tenet of my work to say, share what you like. Listen, if I'm right about something, and if I'm wrong about something, you share it. You learn from it. It's so important. And if we do have a powerhouse of ethics within the kind of European community, the best we can do is say, this is what we're finding, this is what we're thinking about, so please be careful. Even if we're not quite developing the next Skynet or whatever fanciful idea we want to, well, not so fanciful anymore, idea we want to put forward. So I don't think we should look at this as a negative. I think it's a positive.
I really like that idea of publishing bad practice as well to say this didn't work.
Because this is what we've learned from.
Yeah, and I think years ago there was somebody who'd started up the Journal of the Null Hypothesis to show things that had never worked. And I think in the time it would save us running experiments if we knew what people had tried and failed to do. I think one of the other things we need to be wary about is where people get their funding from. And in light of Epstein and MIT, there are lessons to be learned there. And there are some dubious investments going on. I mean, there are companies in the UK who are accepting money from Saudi Arabia, for example, to do massive AI development, and I would be quite concerned about that kind of thing going on. So I think as universities, we have to very carefully consider who is becoming a partner in this research.
Great. Questions? I know there was one. Okay, we've got one here. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Rosie Niven. I'm from JISC. I'm just interested in, it's been a really good discussion, by the way. I'm just interested in where you draw the line between when it comes to learning analytics products, between something that's helpful to students and something that's intrusive and potentially damaging to their progress. Do you feel that the current generation of learning analytics projects has overstepped that line yet? And do you think that guidance on ethics would help? I mean, for example, we've got guidance around AR and data privacy for users of our learning analytics service, and it's also being used by other universities too. And I'd also say that I think Nathan is right that technology wouldn't replace human decision making when it comes to teaching and learning.
Okay, good. So another comment on learning analytics. There was another question. Yep. Thank you.
I'm Bhuvada. I'm a student from India. My question goes back to the mental health point. What I want to know is, when we're talking about mental health, a simple action of washing hands repeatedly can either be an OCD or it can just be a normal habit. What I want to know is, can AI ever replace the ability of human intelligence to judge what is normal and what is a disease?
So there's been quite a, just to move both. There's been some work recently on the, there was a team developing AI that could detect psychosis from movement, and you know, because the way someone walks can be an indicator of that. And they said in a talk, I was listening to a talk at this recently, and it was at a psychotherapist conference. And you know, people said, oh, have you talked about, you know, deploying this wider? What if you use this at airports to find out if people were behaving suspiciously? And they said, well, that's ridiculous, because in airports people are stressed. How can you tell if it's just stress behaviour or if it's something that is a mental health problem? And I think I'm really wary about that. I'm very wary about facial recognition. I'm very wary about monitoring of behaviour. I think it's intrusive, and I think it's not just that there might be error, it's that the error can have such huge implications on someone's life and the stigma around it as well. So I'm really against that kind of thing. I think the AI can identify things and maybe identify it better than we can, but the reasoning behind it is something that falls so far behind that I'm like with you, I'm worried that it can't be done. In terms of I don't know enough about learning analytics and AI. That's something I want to find out more about. But I agree that I think, you know, I think it can be beneficial. So for the only kind of experience I have are things like Semantic Scholar that can help people track reading and research and things like that. So, I think they can be very beneficial, but it's knowing at what point you need to step in and use your own judgment. And I try to, with students, the really nice thing about working in a digital humanities department is that we are taking all our teaching on AI from a critical aspect. So we are teaching, you know, these are the privacy ramifications, these are the societal ramifications. And it's interesting to watch more and more computing departments are starting to do this now and say it's not just about what we can build, it's about how we use it as well. And I think that there's such a difference in privacy expectations generationally that things I am worried about, my students wouldn't be at all concerned about. And then other things that don't worry me, they would be much more hesitant about. Mm. And I think it's trying to find, trying to explain the ramifications of things. And I could learn a lot from my students about technology, but I think also it's my place to say, don't forget that your data is always out there and being tracked. Maybe you want to do stuff to stop that.
Would you say that you are a bit more conservative in how you want your data to be used compared to your students?
Possibly. I mean, I might be a bit of an outlier because I sit on the board of a privacy group. So,
right.
I won't have a voice assistant in my home, but then a lot of tech people I know won't have a voice assistant in their home. So, you know, I think, but I think when you, a lot of the time you'll get the argument, you know, I've got nothing to hide. My life is out there. Mm. I'm happy to put things on social media. And I do, I spill everything out on Twitter. I'm like notoriously bad at just like no boundaries between what I say online and what I say in real life. And I'm not bothered at all. But I think that when you explain the ramifications to people saying, you know, it's not just about what you're saying in this moment, it's about long-term tracking, it's about amalgamation of data. When that data is brought together and aggregated, there's a picture of your life there that it's very hard to undo if someone gets the wrong idea. So I think it's about, sure, share what you want, but just always be wary about what can be rediscovered about you through it.
Nathan?
And I think there's the counterbalance to that is that when it's in your gift to control the sharing of information, that's very different to when someone else shares information about you. And we saw this with Cambridge Analytica when it came down to it. You know, which Battlestar Galactica character are you? Reply to the survey. You know, there's any number of psychometric evaluations going on behind the scenes of that algorithm that are going to be used by a company and then sold to for purposes for which you may not agree. When it comes down to it. But you had no control over that decision because you didn't know that would happen when it came down to it. So I wouldn't repeat past mistakes. At the same time, where it's useful and where you've got a support network of people who can help advise the student for whatever the analytics may show up, that's where it becomes important. And the same is true for your point about a diagnosis of OCD and so forth. You know, when does something that's taboo and weird, to use a very carefully chosen word there, suddenly become, well, actually, it's not so weird. It's not actually that taboo. We see this repeatedly. We have to update the algorithm. We have to retrain the algorithm to make sure that it understands that. And if it's going to actually make a diagnosis, then you have all manner of regulatory oversight to do that. if it's misused out of context, you have real trouble. But we've, I think in the higher education sector, particularly if you want to sit on interview panels, we've all undergone things like unconscious bias training, which I think is amazing. You know, it really is a learning experience. So how are you going to unconsciously sort of train algorithms to screen out unconscious bias? We have to repeat these things because expectations change and interpretations change as well. So it is a dangerous area, I think, and that's why it's so heavily regulated when we develop new devices and drugs. But we had this issue, I think, with the learning analytics. We've had this issue with apps online. So I mean, there were apps out there a couple of years ago, probably still are, that would claim to be able to diagnose if you were HIV positive, for example, with no regulatory oversight whatsoever. Can you just imagine scared people downloading this and getting a diagnosis that may or may not be the case? You know, you've got to make sure that that's regulated and warn people against it, and warn the distributors of these things as well.
Two years ago, Stanford released a paper, the Gaydar paper, that said they could detect whether or not someone was gay from their picture. And they, first of all, they didn't ask anyone whose picture they used. They downloaded the pictures off a dating site. And they, that when they published this, there was a big outcry. You know, this is, they said, oh, we can definitely tell. And their defense was, well, we thought someone would do it, so we thought we'd do it. You know, we thought we'd do it to show it could be done. Right? This is not a good defense. You know, this didn't need to be done. And when people tried to replicate that experiment, actually, it didn't really work. And they found out that even if you blurred the faces, it was still giving the same kind of detection rate. So it's clearly based on other things, right? There are other cues about clothes and glasses and things like that. So it wasn't even a particularly valid study. But it was this defense that, well, you know, we're the good guys. We did it, but we did it to show that it could be done. And they're like, yeah, that's fine. Now you take that software to somewhere like Chechnya, where people are being killed for being gay, right? This is, you know, this is a massive problem. So I think we have to, and for that to come out of a university and not have got through, you know, not to be stopped by an ethics board is quite frightening, really. And I think we should be putting anything with AI should be going through, well, anything with people involved needs to go through ethical review boards. We all have done that. But anything with AI, I think we're not quite up to speed on just looking at the ramifications of that. And when it comes to projects that use people's data and it's sensitive data, that should be flagged as a high risk project.
What do you guys think about, we're talking about AI regulation, so I guess this is the time to ask this question. How is that going to happen? I mean, is this going to be national? Is there going to be some international AI regulation task force that flies around making sure Stanford experiments aren't happening? I mean, how is this ever going to be tackled?
I wish we had the answer.
I can eventually. Sorry, I've got
ideas. So you go first, and I'll see.
So, arguably, we already have a lot of the structure in place. If you look at the higher education sector, with the arrival of GDPR, if you're using data for something high risk, you conduct a data protection impact assessment, either through your research group or your data protection office, but the provision should be there. That gives you a firm understanding of what you're proposing before you start building it, in effect. You have approvals from funders that you have to get through as well, who always demand ethics review. Then there's the ethics review that has to happen. Now, it's not just a sort of tick box exercise here. There is a tapestry of governance for our work. And increasingly, we see that major publications will not publish articles that haven't gone through ethics review, or there's not a good reason why it hasn't gone through ethics review. It's really important to bear that in mind. So within the kind of areas of higher education and research, there are structures in place, but more generally, there are structures in place. I'm coming to why it's not so great in a moment. But certainly for diagnostic tools, we have the European Medicines Agency, and like in the UK, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority, that makes you go through the compliance for developing medical devices, in effect. We have our Information Commissioner's Office. We have any number of other certifications that you can apply from ISO and so forth. Now, a lot of these are not optional. This is bread and butter. You've got to be doing it. The issue we have is that we don't fully understand the scope and the ramifications of AI. It's unpredictable, as I was saying before. How do you apply a regulatory process that's used to being able to predict outcomes to something that can do something unpredictable? We've had some thought about how you might measure this. So my feeling is, do we want another body to look at those elements? but what would they be looking at? Mm. Or do we empower the existing regulatory infrastructures to do their jobs as effectively as they can and interpret new regulation like GDPR, which is new, it's a baby, it's been 18 months, it's still landing, we still don't know what compliance really looks like, especially in something the innovation space with AI. So let's not throw more oversight at something without fully understanding it, and also empowering the oversight bodies we have already to be able to do things in context. So that's my view on it. So, all right, step one of the 12-step program. We know we've got a problem here. Can we now try to understand it a little bit better so that we can regulate it properly and educate people to work with it effectively? And I think that's where we need to start. Mm. It's like, you know, throwing regulatory kind of credits at a new problem. We'll get an oversight board to have a look at it. No. You've got to understand it in context first. Mm.
Do you see that expanding, though, to the private sector?
Well, I think the private sector is, my main experience is working with pharma on joint collaborations and everything. And pharma is an industry that is well used to heavy regulation when it comes down to it. And I think the that kind of oversight, they have to go through it. They have to go through the MHRA procedures. It takes about 18 years to get a new drug to market when it comes down to it. The R&D costs are huge. And I think that the model is already there. And there's some failures with it as well. I think what AI brings us is an opportunity to look at this in a more expedient manner, but in a careful way. And I think we have to go along with it. GDPR was the first step in major regulation of the tech industry, at least in Europe, and the international communities that are following GDPR as well.
We've got about a minute and a half left, so I'll give you the last word, Kate.
Okay, very quickly, I think that corporations need some form of auditing to go on to. So there are millions of ethical guidelines out there now for AI. Well, not millions, but at least 40. Alan Winfield, who's a professor of robotics at Bristol, has compiled them all. They all overlap. They all say things like, don't be bad, don't be biased, da-da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. None of them are concrete implementable plans because it varies so much. I think what we're going to see, there have been some attempts at a global goal of a sort of ethics guide to this, but I mean, we can't even agree on a guide of ethics, you know, for people in one room, so how we do that across the world is a whole other thing. The closest we've got is the Declaration of Human Rights, and if we can sort of that kind of goals to work towards, maybe that's the thing. But I think what we're going to see are more and more checks on corporations where people call them out. So we can't necessarily make them do things ethically, but we can start critiquing them and saying, okay, if you want to sell more of your product, we want to guarantee that you're doing this ethically. We're going to bring in a company to audit you. So there's probably a space to set up auditing companies. In fact, I'm just going to go and start one up right now because that sounds quite good. maybe that's the new space, is kind of ethical auditing.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe it could even develop into some sort of like 15% ethical, this company, like we're seeing when we buy flights right now.
And carbon emissions, the same offsetting. Way we see it with carbon offset and things like that.
Fantastic. Well, that's all we've got time for, but I think we could definitely expand this to another hour. So thank you very much, Kate and Nathan. Please join me in thanking them. And
you're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.